AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 349 for September 29th of 2016, Driving with Pain. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gary Vasilash.
I'm back.
You're back. Let's do a show.
Let's do that. So I was driving the Prius Prime last week, but I can't tell you about it until next week. So,
I know. You could show us pictures, but you can't talk about the car.
Exactly.
Right. And what, Toyota showed you a bunch of other things.
Just mid-cycle.
The 86 and former FRS.
That's right.
A few other things, right? Mm-hmm. What, they redo the Sienna minivan?
Yeah, just
minor stuff.
Just minor stuff.
Okay, next week.
The Prime was Prime.
Oh, there you go. Well, let's let everybody know who's in the studio with us this week. It's Henry Payne, but he's a guest. He's not one of our our journalist panel here.
I'm in the hot seat this week.
You're in the hot seat, and you brought your car with you.
Yeah.
And because we want to talk about racing, and I guess this is a vintage race car, right, even though it's not that old.
Well, 1990. So my kids were born in 1990, 92, so.
Yeah, so it is vintage.
I guess it is vintage. It's older than my kids.
So tell us what it is.
This is a Lola 90. So this comes from the SCCA Sports 2000 class that was formed in the late 1970s. And this was basically the third and last generation of the Sports 2000 racers that came in the late 90s. Some of them are still made today. There's a company named Carber in Wisconsin that still makes these cars. Lola's bankrupt. It doesn't make these anymore, but this type of car is still eligible to race in the SCCA P1 class, but for the most part, these cars have all come down into vintage racing, and I'm racing this Lola typically along with 20 or 30 other guys.
20 or 30 other cars like this, that's a lot. That's a good field.
Yeah, they're really good fields, and they're as good as they were in SCCA back in the day, so... Really quick, there's as quick a car as you can find, really, shy of a carbon fiber tub. These are aluminum tubs.
And who's the organizing series that puts this on?
So we just raced this last weekend with SVRA down in VIR, Virginia International Raceway. But there are multiple vintage groups around the country that host these cars. So there's the P1 series that's still in SCCA, but really Sports 2000 has come into vintage. So we have our own series, which is about 10 races over the course of the year,
all around the country,
right, where you can gather points. But they're raced with different organizing bodies. So SVRA was last weekend. We raced with VRG earlier in the year up at. Grattan,
here in Michigan,
we go to Watkins Glen, we go to Road Atlanta, we go to Road America. Mid-Ohio, right? Mid-Ohio, yeah.
So really good tracks.
Yeah, we're racing at all the top tracks in the country. So it's really good racing.
What qualifies as a vintage car?
That's a good question. That's sort of what the vintage groups define, because, the vintage groups they can't race current. Because it's amateur racing for guys like me that own these things, but at the same time, they're in the business of attracting people to gate. You know, they can go to a track and say, you know, we can put on a vintage event and you'll get X gate. So it's always a tricky balance. I think it has more to do with what cars have been popular in the past. So this was a very popular, very competitive SCCA class. Particularly in the late 80s, 90s, and so we've recreated that in vintage and the racing. These cars are still very quick and very entertaining for a crowd. But you also still have we're in so-called Group 7 racing in vintage racing. Group 1, you still have old Alphas, Porsche bathtubs, late 50s, early 60s GT cars. And you get big fields of those cars because there's great interest there and great racing.
But your car couldn't go into the Group One.
No, right. So all of vintage racing is segmented by year and by class. Trans Am, for example, used to be very popular in vintage racing. The late 60s, early 70s Trans Am. Mark Donohue, where Penske cut his teeth. It was a tremendously competitive series, and that did very well. You had huge fields, 40, 50 car fields in vintage racing for a long time. But all those cars have become so valuable to collectors over time that series has kind of fallen away. So it's interesting. I mean, the vintage organizers need to be aware not only who has the cars that can race them, but also what's popular among people who want to come out.
So let's talk about this car a little bit, because for those who are only listening to the podcast and don't see the pictures in the video that we're running, it looks like a mini Can-Am car, you know, like about a three-quarter scale Can-Am car made by Lola. It's what, aluminum monocoque chassis?
Aluminum monocoque, right. Aluminum monocoque tub with tube frame support at the front and back.
Double wishbones at all four corners,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Disc brakes, I'm assuming, at all four
Disc
corners?
Disc brakes all the way around, slick tires all the way around, running 8 and 9 inch tires front to rear.
And you've got a 2-liter Ford engine, right? A Pinto engine
is what anybody
in the U.S. would know it as.
Right, and it's a true spec racer in that sense. I mean, the pro racing really has all gone to spec. Now.
Holds down costs, makes it easier
right.
to maintain and all that, because you guys are amateurs. You're not working on this all around the week.
That's right. Well, and it's really the way road auto racing has gone. I mean, when my father and I got into vintage racing back in the late 70s, early 80s, we were racing Porsches and Ferraris and all that great stuff that came out of the Le Mans tracks in the 1960s and early 70s. But they were all bespoke cars created by the manufacturers with 12-cylinder Ferrari engines in them and 12-cylinder Porsche engines, and those just became so expensive to make over time, unless you had manufacturer money, that over time the racing has become sponsor-supported, and so budgets have become much more crucial. And so most spec racing, from IndyCar down to Sports 2000 racing in SCCA, has gone spec, with spec engines, spec tires, that sort of thing, in order to hold the cost down.
Sure, makes sense. And then you were telling me before we started the show, this is about 1,100 pounds,
yep.
So very lightweight.
Yes.
You've got about 150 horsepower out yep. of that Pinto engine.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did the math, the power-to-weight ratio. This is a little over 7 pounds per horsepower. And in my book, anything under 10 pounds is wicked fast. So this is a wicked fast car.
Yeah, this is a quick little thing, but It's still a 2-liter car, so it's really a tremendous car for people to get into racing. My sons have just started racing in the last couple years, and they're coming up through go-karts and through barber school, Skip Barber Formula Car School, and this is a great way to get into racing because you don't have so much power that it overwhelms the tires, and it really teaches you racing skills because you got to keep your speed up because you only have 2,000 cc's behind you.
I got a great secret for you. If you want to keep your speed up, don't touch the brakes.
Yeah, and that's the way these cars really are. I mean, you're trying to be off and on the gas, full on, full off, because they're tremendous handling cars. They're very stiff. And as I say, it's a really good teacher of racing as well as being a quick car. This car, just to give folks a sense of how rapidly race car technology advances, the 1970 Porsche 908, which was a Le Mans winning 3-liter class car in 1970, 400 horsepower, 1,300 pound car. This car is another 20 years on. 20 years later, has only 150 horsepower and is doing the same lap times at VIR.
You told me that earlier, and what blew my mind is they're roughly the same weight.
Same weight. Yeah, this is 1,100 pounds. The 908's 1,300 pounds. It's the difference between a aluminum monocoque tub and a full tube frame.
And that's what I'm getting at. It's not as if this car has a much better power-to-weight ratio than the Porsche. It does not.
That's
the
right.
Porsche has a better power-to-weight ratio.
That's right.
And what you're saying is, because of the design of the suspension, the geometry, but especially the stiffness of the chassis, this car sitting here might have won Le Mans in 1970.
It's really remarkable.
You can only go back in time.
Yeah. Well, and then you come to today's the modern sports car today, like a Porsche 919 that won Le Mans this year.
This
right?
year. Yeah, I remember the Toyota dropped out with 5 minutes
that's right.
to go.
Yeah, that's right. That very dramatic end. So that's a carbon fiber chassis, and the prototypes in that class with carbon fiber chassis versus an IMSA prototype car, which is still using aluminum monocoque tub. The modern carbon fiber sports car tub car, the 919, is only 6 seconds off of Formula One car times at places like Circuit of the Americas. They're a full 13 seconds quicker than an IMSA prototype because of the difference in that tub technology. So the advancement continues today.
So what kind of a transmission? We mentioned the other aspects of the powertrain.
Yeah, so it's a Hewland transmission, which is a very common transmission in auto racing. You find it in formula racing as well as sports car racing. Very robust engines. This is a classic H pattern, four-speed. Hewland box, and you find them in Lolas, you find them in IndyCar racing. I mean, Hewland has been putting out great
transmissions
for a long time.
I mean, I since the 60s at least,
right.
I would say.
That's right. And then the car is taken care of for me by Speed Unlimited Racing up in Chicago. Jim Kelly's race shop, he takes care of a number of Sports 2000s. He was a former Sports 2000 racer, very skilled, very knowledgeable. Man, and he takes care of the cars for us. He's got a number of clients, and he takes them to the track for us, and we all fly to the track and meet him and go have fun.
So, do you have any sponsors to help defray the bills? You got a couple of what looks like sponsors.
Yeah, looks like sponsors, but yeah, they aren't paying anything. No, I'm a Detroit News auto columnist, so I got the Detroit News on the front. Very very proud to be with the Detroit News. And then my family has a small manufacturing company back in West Virginia that my father created years ago, and I'm still on the board of. And so.
And that's Pain Controls.
That's Pain Controls. Okay. So yeah, we give them a little publicity, but you got to have TV really to attract sponsors, and we're just amateur racers having fun.
So you mentioned your father got you into this. Tell us a little about that.
Well, I grew up at the track. I mean, my father was a brilliant man. He was he was an aeronautical engineer who then started an electronics company, and so the electronics company that was his that put dinner on the table. But he was always fascinated by the aviation industry and by aerodynamics in general, and that got him into racing at a very young age when he got out of college. And so I kind of grew up going to the racetrack with him. His first race car was an AC Bristol. And then he got into Porsches. You know, being an engineer, he was naturally attracted to the Porsche engineering, felt that was the best engineering in the business. And so he bought some Porsches off the when the factory stopped racing them, some of the Le Mans cars back in the 60s and 70s. And I started racing with him in the 90s, and we had a lot of fun together driving those Porsches. We had a 906, I had a 906 and a 908, and he would drive a 907. But over time, those cars have just become so valuable; they become collector's items. I mean, we were just racers. I mean, he was a racing engineer. You know, he wasn't in it for the glory. He just loved to race the best car out there. And over time, those cars have become seven-figure cars.
Wow.
I mean, they're incredibly expensive. They're very expensive to keep up. And so I wanted to keep racing, and I wanted my sons to race with me. And so I got into these cars, into the Lolas and the Sports 2000s that are just as quick but are much more affordable to race.
That's so cool. Who was faster, you or your dad?
Over time, I got a little bit faster than dad. And I'm afraid the same thing's happening to me.
I say, who's faster, you or your kids?
Yeah, this weekend down at VIR, my son Henry actually clocked a quicker lap than I did down at VIR for the first time. And that's pretty neat.
That's how it should be, actually.
That's right. Every generation should be better than the last.
Hey, look, let's take a quick commercial break right now. We'll come back and talk about more of this. But, Carmen, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back talking vintage racing with the Lola. Is it appropriate to call it a T80?
No, it's just a 90. It's an interesting different. We were down at VIR this weekend racing, and there were T70s out there, the famous V8 powered Le Mans car from the early 70s. These 500, 600 horsepower beasts, and those are T's. So that end of sports racing, I guess you could call it the endurance Lolas, the T70s. They went on through T298s, I believe, by the late 70s, are different than these Lola 90s, which just go by. There's a they start as a 596, and the numbers get jumbled, but they don't have T's in front of them. And Lola, of course, now is bankrupt.
Yeah.
And is owned by
Multimatic.
Oh,
really? Multimatic.
Yeah, same company.
Same guys making the Ford GT.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So Multimatic just bought Lola, which is interesting.
And what's even more interesting is the fact that at the very beginning of the Lola company, that basically Ford had one of the founders of Lola work with it on the development of the original GT.
Really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So coming around full circle.
What do you have to do with this car during the season? I mean, like a set of tires, how long does that last?
We're getting a set of tires out of a weekend. That's the expense.
Wow.
That's the big expense in the sport. When you're running slick tires, and we're generally getting 8 heat cycles, which is 8 sessions out of a car.
And so one weekend, you throw them away.
Yeah, one weekend, $1,000 for tires, and they're out the door. So that's really the big expense in this type of racing, because these cars are pulling north of 2G on the track, a very high G, very quick cars, and that's very demanding on the tires. And you get the heat cold cycle, and they wear out after about 8 cycles.
Does that mean you don't drive in the rain?
Yeah, I mean, racing. Yeah, I don't make money at this sport, so the risk of rain.
Do other guys do? I mean, with slicks?
They do. Yeah, so we actually don't bring rain tires to the track. Just sort of we kind of don't tempt ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real glory in club racing that rewards the risk of rain racing, but a lot of guys do. They enjoy it.
In Formula One, of course, it's a whole nother ball game, and they deliberately develop the compound so that these drivers have got to go out, do an out lap at the right thing, bring the tire up to the proper temperature. Then do you have to worry about anything like that other than just heat up the tires?
Yeah, we just you kind of learn. Usually these things heat up. We run Avons, and they heat up pretty quick. You usually get them up to temperature in a lap. But we run with Trans-Am is one of the partners that we run with at tracks. We're VIR with Trans-Am, and a lot of those guys put on the tire warmers so that they're good to go as soon as they go out on the track. But they have sponsors, and a lot of this is just where you are on the expense scale. Yeah, the tire warmers just aren't worth the cost to us.
What's the best part about it for you? I mean, this is a big time commitment on your part, obviously.
Yeah.
But hell, if you love it, it's not a big deal. But what do you especially love about going vintage racing?
I really love the escape. You go to a race weekend and it's so concentrated. I mean, the concentration is intense. You know, the great Hemingway quote: bullfighting, mountain climbing, and auto racing are the only real sports. All the rest are games. I mean, there is some risk in this sport, and you really have to concentrate on what you're doing from an engineering and handling setup in order to go fast. And so you get lost in that weekend. And I love that, and I love the fact that I've always been able to race with family. It's neat to see my kids coming up and learning the skill. So, it's really a great escape from my daily life.
So is a weekend Saturday qualifying, Sunday racing, or?
Yeah, we were, you know, depending on the event, but typically it's Friday practice, and then we're qualifying and racing on Saturday and Sunday. Yeah. Some weekends are a little bit longer. We'll go to Circuit of the Americas in November, and that'll be a 5-day event. So kind of depending on how big the event is, how many entries there are. Circuit of the Americas is huge. It should be 400 entries down there.
Is it a timed race when you go out?
Yeah, so we're just running sprints. And again, the sort of the magic for vintage racing from a fan is that you can come and see
a lot of races.
Oh, you can see everything from late 50s bathtub Porsches racing to 1990 spec racer Lola to a early 2000 Audi R8 Le Mans diesel powered Le Mans car out there. So for the fan, it's a tremendous way to see generations of race car. And then as far as the racing goes, that limits us. We're usually doing 10-lap sprint races, which is good. You know, we're not in the best of shape being amateur racers, so we get.
You don't work out 5 hours a day?
No. don't have a trainer. it's hard work when you're racing at 2 Gs. You tire pretty quickly.
So what is your sense? I mean, over the years you've been participating in this sport, are the fans as enthusiastic today as they were back when your father was racing with you?
I think they are. You know, they call this we always refer to this as the second golden age of muscle cars in the production world. And I think that's translated to racing as well. I mean, there's an enormous amount of racing out there these days. Part of that has been fueled by vintage, which vintage racing really came online in the early 1980s as people realized there was nostalgia. So we're still feeding on the nostalgia of the first golden age of racing of muscle cars. And now I think we're seeing a lot of these cars out there today in similar series. Trans Am today, it's very different than it was back in the 1970s, Trans Am, but it's still back. It still has Corvettes and Camaros and Mustangs and all these great muscle cars on the track. Formula One, Le Mans. Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of out there for a fan. So, yeah, I think there's still interest.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting that you bring that up, Gary, because that was one of the comments I heard at this year's Dream Cruise, is it didn't seem that there was as many vintage cars this year, but a lot of brand-new muscle cars out there. And, you know, to your point, Henry, this is the real golden age or a second golden age of performance vehicles. In fact, one of the topics I wanted to ask you guys about, you know, going into the news is Ford's announced its sales of its performance cars. Yeah. In fact, I'm getting a notice from the control room here. We got to take another very quick break. Let's come back and talk about performance cars. I know we got a number from Dr. Data and other things to talk about. So we're going to take a quick break right now.
From Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern.
Okay, we're back, and let's just finish that thought of Ford's performance cars that we started to talk about before that quick break. But Ford came out and said they're going to sell what, Gary? 200,000 performance cars?
Globally.
But
right.
Still.
Right. It's a huge number. It's doubled what they were just a few years ago. And so this would be Mustangs and the Focus
But not just
RS.
All Mustangs, right? This would be the 350s,
right.
The 350Rs, Focus RS, Ford GT, obviously.
Yeah. So it's Focus RS, Focus ST, Fiesta ST. Forgot the Fiesta.
Yeah.
The Raptor, I'm sure, would be in there, too. Yeah.
Shelby GT 350 and 350R Mustang sold off for 2017.
I know. And what blew my mind when I saw that number of 200,000 performance cars, that's how much Porsche sells in a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, we could make adjustments for, you know, the dollar amounts involved. Nonetheless, for Ford to sell 200,000 performance cars shows they made the right decision, I think. What was it? A couple of years ago, they formed the Ford Performance Group, you know, as a business entity.
Right.
Because they said, hey, we see money in this stuff, and man, were they right.
Yeah, and then the halo car was this Ford GT coming back. And, yeah, I mean, it's a great segue from what we were talking about with racing, because so much of Ford's racing DNA is part of this performance marketing. I mean, the halo car is the Ford GT that won Le Mans in 1965. And here we are 50 years later, and they're still milking that. And you know, Gary asking about the popularity of racing today, you have more racetracks in this country than you've ever had before. I mean, not just racetracks that are dedicated to racing, but club tracks, Monticello, Audubon, Thermal in California, all these club tracks.
M1 right here in Michigan.
Right, that are basically golf course models. You have so many people.
So it's basically rich guys with powerful cars,
yeah,
who don't want to get tickets, so
right.
So they
go to their club track. Yeah, instead of playing golf, they're taking their Focus RS or their Mustang GT350 so they can really test it. But
rich guys, right? I mean, for the clubs, yeah, obviously.
Right.
But when you look at, you know, quarter mile dirt track racing, still very popular in this country. Sprint cars, late model stock cars. I mean, the list goes on and on. Hill climbs. It's amazing how much racing is going on. And yet, when you look at the big leagues, Formula One, NASCAR, IndyCar, and the like, you know, the popularity of motorsports is dropping.
Yeah.
I mean, measured by TV ratings or attendance at races, it's going down. Yeah. And yet, at the grassroots level, I don't think it's ever been stronger.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and a company like Ford, which is arguably as green a company as there is out there, you know, that they're on the cutting edge of plug-in and electric development. At the same time, they obviously feel that performance is just as important an indicator of where they are as a brand, and those two coexist,
yeah,
which is a wonderful thing.
Maybe it's like carbon offsets. So they
carbon fiber offsets.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. I mean, if we look, you know, we were talking earlier, you look at the numbers, though, in terms of muscle cars, and, you know, Camaro is down.
Sales are down, right?
Sales are down year to date, off by nearly 15%. Charger down, Challenger down, Mustang up. Okay, and that's the only one that's, I mean, and it's significantly increased in terms of its sales.
Yeah.
And those are just U.S. sales.
U.S. sales.
And we know that Mustang's selling well globally now.
Right, and I have a feeling that accounts for a lot of that gain that they're achieving globally. I mean, I just think that
good point.
A very, very clever idea to take the, you know, quintessential American pony car,
yeah,
and bring it around the world, which they hadn't done up until this current generation, yeah, vehicle.
But the other thing, and you know, it takes some analysis to figure this out, but look in that same price point, that $30,000 to $40,000 price point where those things live, and look at all the hot hatches that have come into the market.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
yeah,
trying to slake this demand for performance. The, you know, the VW has now gone to an R, a Golf,
right,
R,
yep,
above their GTI.
Right.
Ford has taken that ST and gone to an RS. So maybe that's the competition for those muscle cars.
Mm-hmm.
They're front wheel drivers, but
so people don't
just
necessarily want to race in straight lines anymore. They want to race quickly. Gymkhana-like, and Tanner Faust and all those guys who are doing the tricks, that they want to do that as well.
Yeah, that's right. The Red Bull Series is
Ken Block and those guys, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And they have more utility. The hatches are a better utility car,
mm-hmm,
in terms of getting around and carrying people than the muscle cars. So maybe they're bleeding some of those sales.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
And then I'm currently driving an Infiniti Q50S. So you see it in the luxury cars. Every luxury car now has to have a performance
brand. Brand, even. So S with Infiniti, AMG, Mercedes, M, BMW,
right,
V, Cadillac.
Right.
And whoever else is out there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's really real, mm-hmm, demand for this stuff.
Okay, now we got to turn to another,
right,
part of the show.
So,
time for Dr. Data.
Okay, and this all wraps together. This will be the easiest number that we've had on the show in quite a while. So, Carmen, could you please bring that up?
$35 million.
$35 million and change.
In terms of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
$35 million, and we got to guess what that is.
Well, once you guess what that is, you know what that number is.
Well, there's a fuzzy outline of some vintage race car in the background. I'm going to guess it's a Ferrari. I'm going to guess that that is the highest price ever paid for a car.
Henry?
I think that's right. I think John's got it.
Boy, you guys are so close. So close. All right, Carmen, bring up the second one, please. Okay, so this is a 57 Ferrari 335 Sport. Okay, this is the most expensive car sold at auction this year.
Wow.
Okay, through the year, most expensive car. It was sold in Paris at a auction, Arturo Paris. And it's the second most expensive car ever sold.
Whoa.
So I will guess that the most expensive is another Ferrari, and it's a Ferrari GTO.
I was going to say Testarossa.
1962 Ferrari 250 GTO, serial number 3851, sold for $38 million back in 2014.
Wow.
So rich guys, fast cars, racing, it all comes together.
And I'll give you a great little story. 1969, I'm at the Bell Fountain Hill Climb with my father, who had just brought his first Porsche, and there is a Ferrari GTO sitting there at the Hill Climb for sale for $7,000. We walked around it, and my dad said, "Italian piece of junk, solid rear axle."
But he was a Porsche guy, right?
That's right.
And probably at some point somebody said, "Clem, why aren't you running that Ferrari up the hill?" And he said, "Because it got to be too valuable."
That's right.
Just like you're talking about why you don't race Porsches anymore.
That's right.
Well, we were talking a little bit here about Volkswagen, and boy, this has been a big week, not a good week necessarily for...
Well, they haven't had a good week in a year, right?
With the ongoing diesel situation and... It's sort of interesting. Henry, we had you on the show like when that story broke last year. So, once again, full circle thing.
Yeah.
So,
two big bad pieces of news.
Well, so Audi lost its head of technical development, who...
Head of R&D.
Hadn't been in the job for a while, and interestingly enough, he was the Audi former head of engine development. So, Audi still has the problem with the 3-liter diesel. There's no identified fix for that. And... The Justice Department is now looking at how big a criminal fine.
Yeah, that's what everybody should realize is up to now, all Volkswagen has agreed to do is spend over $16 billion paying money to the EPA and the California Air Resources Board and the Department of Transportation for breaking emissions regulations.
Right.
Now the Department of Justice is stepping in and saying, okay, and here's what the criminal fine is going to be, although they're still trying to figure that out, right?
Right, and so they're looking at it from the point of view of, you know, how do you fine them without breaking the company?
Without running it out of business.
Right, taking it out of business.
And I hasten to add, too, that the DOJ has run other companies out of business deliberately. And the two that come to my mind are Enron, which it deliberately took to pieces, and then Arthur Andersen. It's... auditing firm that audited all the numbers for Enron. Neither one of those companies exists today because the DOJ did take them out of business.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just DOJ. I mean, governments all over see the advantage of suing VW just to stock their own coffers. You know, you look at what VW is paying the state of California, and you look at in the line items there, and part of it is to build an electric infrastructure.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's a every government sees profit in these fines. So it's a tricky time for VW. I just one of the shames. You just don't cheat. You know, that's the lesson. I mean, you can cheat in politics, but you can't cheat in business. And it's a real shame because I was just on the VW Golf All Track Drive, and VW trying to get product out there so that they can change the conversation. Great product. They're not bringing any more diesels into this country. And diesel is a great technology.
It is.
It's a wonderful technology. I just drove the new diesel engine in Europe that's going into the Passat, which we will never see in this country. And it's really a pity. Great torque, great gas mileage, and we won't see it because of this.
From Volkswagen.
That's right.
Meanwhile, others are bringing diesels in here.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. So last Thursday evening in Chicago, Chevrolet took the wraps off of the 2018 Equinox, and they made quite a big deal out of this. Now, this wasn't a drive. This was literally, here's an Equinox on stage, and we'll bring the curtain up, and we'll see the Equinox. And then they did this at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, and they had a number of displays set up showing different aspects of this vehicle. But they're going to have an all-turbocharged engine lineup, and included is a 1.6-liter turbo diesel, 136 horsepower, 236 feet-pound of torque. And, you know, I asked Steve Majoros of who we'd had him on the show a few months ago, and you know, I said, isn't diesel dead in this market? I mean, why are you bringing diesel here? Now, part of it is, of course, that, you know, this diesel is coming from Europe. They're using it for Opel. They're using it for Vauxhall. Apparently, it's quite a diesel. It's called the whisper diesel in Europe because it's so quiet. Huh. But, you know, but again, now, is this a good play for Chevy to have a diesel in this car?
Well, I haven't talked to Chevy about it, but I suspect one of the things that's driving it in SUVs is that the batteries work well in the smaller cars, in the lighter weight cars. But as you put batteries into heavier things, it gets really expensive to haul all that weight around on a battery. Diesels are much more efficient in that regard. They're much better in the bigger vehicles. And, you know, Audi, I know, wants to put a diesel in the Q7, their big SUV, and I wonder if Chevy's thinking the same thing. Now that everybody's gone to SUVs, including the tiny Trax, they can get good fuel economy by these things by feeding them with turbo diesels. That'd make a lot of sense.
But your question's a good one, Gary. Is it the right thing for Chevy to do? We'll see, because if you look at their full-size pickups, the Silverado, the diesel sells decently in there. But if you look at the Chevy Cruze, which came out a couple of years ago with a diesel, boy, they can't give those things away. They just didn't sell.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, though, Jaguar's coming in with its whole new platform, you know, its whole new, was it, Ingenium family of engines.
Yeah.
They're putting diesels in both the XKE, the XE and the F-Pace.
Right.
SUV. And another SUV. And Bentley is putting a diesel in the Bentayga.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, we talked all about 48-volt mild hybrid with electric supercharger. That's what they're using. They're taking the same engine out of the SQ7 Audi, and they're dropping that into the Bentayga, but with a diesel engine. And so the marketplace is going to decide whether diesel sells.
Right. I mean, but the thing that it sort of strikes me, and I think this gets to the point of the Cruze more than either the Jag or the Bentley, is the fact that, okay, the regular consumer, not the ultra-high consumer or higher consumer in the case of the Jaguar, what do they hear about diesels? Oh, those are the terrible things that pollute so badly, and didn't Volkswagen have a problem with those things? Oh, I'm not going to buy one of those. That would just be awful. And, you know, and so, yes, having them is good for fuel efficiency, but if no one's buying them.
Yeah, but Gary, think of if and I don't know what Chevy's strategy is, but the Cruze, I don't know why they put a diesel in the Cruze for the reasons you say. But if you introduce them into SUVs where you can show the customer a real difference, not only in fuel mileage, but also in torque, which you need in a heavier vehicle, that may be a way to refresh the idea of a diesel. You know, just the way Buick refreshed its brand by introducing SUVs. Because all these manufacturers, particularly the big ones, still got to sell in Europe where diesels are very popular. So the technology's there, and I can see where they want to bring it here, and maybe it's just a matter of packaging.
Mm-hmm.
It'll work better.
We shall see.
We shall see.
I just find this to be fascinating. I mean, you know, especially in light of this ongoing problem with diesels. I mean, to my mind, and trust me, I enjoy driving them as much as the next guy does. I mean, they're a whole lot of fun, and And as you say, the low-end torque is just amazing, and, you know, that's just great. But just from the point of view as a business proposition, whether it makes a whole lot of sense just to have that.
Yeah.
And maybe this is, you know, you can get a RAV4 with a hybrid, and maybe Chevy just decided, well, we don't want to do the expense, as you say, and put the hybrid there, and we'll keep that technology for the Volt and the Bolt and whatever else, you know. And it was also interesting that I learned, and I don't know if you guys realize this or not, but they consider the Bolt to be a crossover.
Yep.
Well,
I'm serious.
And yeah, I mean, that's true.
I was surprised, and I can tell you are surprised as well.
I'm surprised, yeah.
Well, but the EPA is not going to classify it. They're going to classify it as a car. And in fact, in the NACTOY jury, I believe we have it, a North American Car of the Year, we have it classified as a car. But Chevy is going to market it as a crossover because that's where the market is. And it kind of looks like it's crossover-y looking.
Well, it's a hatchback.
Up in the air a little bit.
And,
yeah.
And, you know, I suppose if I were in charge of marketing, I'd call it a crossover, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's a hatchback. Hey, let's take another quick break right now. We got a lot more to talk about. But, Carmen, let's give a shout-out to our good friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. We've been talking about vintage car racing and diesel engine. Oh, you know, just to finish that Volkswagen thing a minute, you know, all these fines are going to, I think they're going to cripple the company. Not kill it, but cripple it. You know, I was at a Ford event a week ago, and Bill Ford was talking, and one of the things he said, or Mark Fields, excuse me, is the they both talked, but Mark made the point that one of the biggest things that Ford's grappling with right now, and this has got to be true of every single car company, is where do you spend all your money? You got fuel cells and, you know, 48 volts, and you've got lightweighting, and you've got, you know, plant expense, you know. So prioritizing where you spend your, no one's got so much money that they can do it all. So here's Volkswagen, got to pay $16 billion in fines. Who knows what the Department of Justice is going to slap them with. The lawsuits haven't even really gotten to court yet. You know, the buybacks and everything. I mean,
And what about the rest of the world? I mean, you know, I mean, the Koreans are,
yeah,
you know, they're interested.
Koreans arrested a couple of their executives.
Yeah, so they're not going to say,
So
it's all right. Just pay the guys in the U.S. We're good.
Yeah. So when Volkswagen says, oh, we're going to bring out 30 new electric cars in the next decade, where are they going to get the money?
It's a big company. Well, and they're also partially owned by government, right? Doesn't Lower Saxony have a huge
investment?
Has
a stake in it, but
there might be some bailout money there for them.
Yeah,
it can't be that much for
Lower Saxony.
No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe for the entire country of Germany, but they're spending a lot.
But that's the other end of the scale. I mean, it's a huge company. It's the number two company in the world, I believe, in sales. And the other end of this capital question is the smaller companies can't afford a lot of these capital expenditures, and they have to partner. They're going to have to partner. So Volkswagen is a very interesting partner, very good engineering in that company. It's a very interesting partner play for somebody like Mazda or, you know, we were talking a lot about it with FCA when FCA was exploring a partner. So I think VW could make some money there.
Well, Bloomberg did a report on the potential consequence of the criminal charges in terms of money charges, not
prison sentences.
Not prison charges. And so Joel Levington, a Bloomberg intelligent credit analyst, said, and I quote, despite all the damage done, all the damage his reputation has taken, VW is still a company that might be able to generate back $5 billion in free cash flow in 2018. And when you generate that kind of cash, it absolves a lot of sins. So if they got $5 billion in cash flow,
that's pretty good.
That might not be a problem in terms of investing in things.
Okay.
So speaking of FCA, so we just learned that FCA launched the new Jeep Compass in Brazil yesterday, and we're not going to see the new Jeep Compass here until the LA Auto Show in November. What's your take on that, Henry?
Yeah, we've all been wondering about this because, you know, again, to the issue of priorities, FCA obviously has a lot of, it has a lot of priorities. They're trying to build a luxury brand in Alpha. They're trying to rebuild a mainstream brand in Chrysler, but their cash cow is Jeep. You got to keep those Jeeps coming off the line. So, I think we've all been a little surprised that this has been delayed.
Yeah, because let's go back. Chrysler showed this Jeep to the media. Were you there at that?
Yes.
What was that? Last year?
Last year before the Detroit Auto Show.
Before the Detroit Auto Show. They spilled their guts on the whole thing.
Thought it was coming in New York.
And then they said, whoa, everybody, don't say word one about this car. And then they introduced it in Brazil yesterday, and this week. And they still sent out a notice to all the American media, don't you dare publish anything that we told you last year. And, what the hell is going on with this program?
There's no doubt some good reporting out there on it, but it also may be just part of the global strategy. If they're in Brazil, I mean,
building it in Brazil.
Yeah, a big piece of the Renegade.
They're going to build it in China.
Renegade is Italy.
It's Italy, and that's China. Where the rest of the world is. It's on this small stuff like Renegade and Compass.
Right.
And so, you know, if that's what's going on, then that's good for them. I mean, Jeep is a great global brand for them, and the more they can sell them globally, the more it's going to help that company with its other problems.
What do you think, Gary?
I think here's the thing that puzzles me is the fact of, okay, how far can you stretch Jeep before it loses its luster of being, you know, the quintessential American brand? I mean, isn't that what Jeep is? And isn't that why it's so revered around the world? I mean, there are lots of car companies that make vehicles that can go anywhere and do anything, but they're not Jeeps, right?
Yeah.
So if you begin to have these vehicles that are no longer necessarily or even at all American, isn't the luster beginning to fade? And that's what I just wonder about. It just puzzles me. And I mean I understand that they're you know making money hand over fist with the Jeep brand and globally and then domestically with the Ram brand. You know, why would you do that? Why would you necessarily risk, you know, your single biggest market?
I don't know if you're risking anything, only in the sense that, you know, this argument actually goes back 30 years ago when Honda built the first foreign-made car in America, the first Honda Accord that was made in Marysville, Ohio. And that was the big question. And the dealers were biting their nails because that was the worry. Will Americans buy an American-made Honda? And no problems at all. It was never really an issue. And then when BMW came and built the plant in South Carolina, that was the big question. Will people buy BMWs, not just in America, but anywhere in the world, if that BMW was not made in Germany? And, of course, nobody even notices the difference.
Right.
You know, what Sergio has said is the Wrangler always has to be built in America, that is the quintessential American vehicle, has to be built in America. But the rest of the stuff, clearly they don't care.
But couldn't you make the argument, though, that companies like Honda and Toyota, because they have become so ingrained in the United States that they are essentially American companies now, that people don't necessarily look at them as being Japanese companies?
Well, in America, that might be true. But
right.
In the rest of the world, they're perceived as Japanese companies.
So my point is that as you begin to embed yourself in other countries in a significant way, do you not lose your fundamental identity as your nationality?
I don't know. Well, you know, we'll see. I mean, Jeep is just such a powerful brand. Look at Land Rover. It's owned by Indians now.
Right.
And yet people want Land Rovers because they're the quintessential off-road luxury SUV. You know, Jeep is the affordable Land Rover. I don't think it matters where it's built. It's just such a powerful brand. You know, as long as they keep building it with the Jeep Essentials,
Right.
Just the way Land Rover keeps their engineering bar high, I think Jeep's going to sell.
And and Land Rover is moving out of England. They've got, what, a plant going up in Slovakia? Mm-hmm. And Brazil, too? I think. I'm not sure. They were talking about, in fact, they were even talking about building them in Saudi Arabia. That's when I was convinced they've lost their minds. That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Closer to the big market.
Yeah, right, right. But that's a good question, actually. Does, over the long haul, does Jeep start to lose some of its cachet if it isn't truly an American brand?
Mm-hmm. And then when Land Rover goes down market, they've got more competition, right?
Yeah.
And when does GMC come out with something that will be Jeep-like in terms of...
They've got a Jimny coming, I want to say, 2018, that is absolute, so I hear, is aimed right at Jeep. Look, if you're Ford and Chevy, how can you let Jeep just get away with being Jeep? And I say Ford and Chevy. If you're Ford Motor Company and General Motors, how do you let Jeep get away with this for so long? It's like when Chrysler did the original minivan. You know, the other two guys in town here laughed their heads off until they saw the profits rolling in for Chrysler. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just astonishing to me that really the rest of the automotive world has essentially let Jeep go do its own thing.
Yeah, but it's doing it at the same time that its durability numbers are in the basement. I mean, Jeep is still one of the most unreliable brand. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's the power of the brand.
Yeah,
it's,
I wonder how bad.
It's really hard to do.
Look, you know, I'll tell you another company that scores very low in those J.D. Power numbers, Subaru. They can't build cars fast enough.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's why I'm very skeptical of these J.D. Power or even Consumer Reports, quote-unquote, quality numbers. Because I think a lot more goes into owning an automobile than just looking at some survey results.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's what's hard. I mean, it's not just that Chevy and Ford want to be in that space with Jeep, but how do you do it from a brand perspective? I mean, Subaru, you know, really concentrate on what they wanted to be as a brand, as an all-wheel drive, affordable, outdoorsy brand, and that works. And Jeep has figured that out, too. I just think that's really hard to do. I mean, Jeep, you know, you get into a Jeep Renegade, this little $20,000 thing, and you crawl through it, and there's all this World War II nostalgia all over the car. You know, I mean, again, it's just like Ford with performance. They're going back to 1965 Le Mans in order to sell today's cars. Yeah. So that's a long time of a brand marinating and getting cachet.
But you know, you call it nostalgia, and you're right, but it's also heritage.
Yeah.
And heritage counts for a lot.
You know,
this is why, you know, Genesis, the new luxury brand from Hyundai, it's going to struggle for a couple of decades before it truly establishes itself, if it does, as a luxury brand, because heritage counts for so much.
Yeah, particularly in that end of the market.
Especially.
But, you know, it's interesting, if you look at the Renegade and you look at all these throwback items that they put on the inside of the vehicle, but at the same time, if you look at the speedometer where they have the paintball splatter, which is speaking directly to the millennial who's just going, because they're not necessarily going to realize, oh, gee, this won World War II. And you know, I mean, that doesn't really matter. But, I mean, I think that basically it would be possible for a company like Ford, which, I mean, if you go back in history, to go to your point, I mean, you look at those Model Ts, what they did to those things, and they turned them into, like, every vehicle imaginable and to sawmills and to tractors. And, you know, you got a Model T, you can do anything with it. That Ford perhaps even owns that more than Jeep does, and if they would just be able to capitalize on that and just come out with something, because, you know, some company that's going to be able to make, you know, the Raptor is sure as hell going to be able to make something that's going to go anywhere and do anything. I have no doubt of that at all.
Hey, look, we've run out of time. I know we had other things to talk about, but we've burned it all up. So, of course, part of that was talking about Henry burning up the tracks.
Yeah, having fun out there. It's great. It's great to be racing in America.
Well, thanks for bringing your car by, your Lola 90. This is really cool having it in the studio. I've been wanting to do this all year long, as you know. So
yeah, this is neat.
It's really cool. Thanks, Henry, for coming by.
Yeah, thank you, John. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Gary,
appreciate it.
Let's keep doing the show. I'm having fun.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
Great.
But not right now. For now, we're signing off. We want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.